Hey, everybody, and welcome to the Android Central podcast for the week of January 19th, 2017. Happy New Year. I haven't been on a podcast since the dial turned to the year of Trump, and neither have these two gentlemen. To my left in West Virginia, Jerry Hildenbrand. How are you, dude?
Pretty good. How are you?
I'm good. I'm feeling sorry for you guys a little bit. Not for political reasons. Let's not get there. But more just because, you know, it's been a while, and you guys have a lot to talk about. The team, Alex and Andrew, and sorry, not Alex, Andrew and Flo and Phil and Derek and Mark and everybody from CES did their thing a couple of weeks ago, and we'd taken a break, but. You know, you haven't been on the show, and neither has Russell Hawley, and we're really happy to have you. How you, dude?
I was actually on the CES podcast.
Were you? I didn't listen to it, sorry.
It's so great.
You know why? Because I heard that Phil ruined it with his eating.
That was the best part, was Andrew getting mad at Phil throughout the entire podcast. I wish that I had continued recording after we were all done, because the closest thing that Andrew gets to yelling was what happened after the end of that podcast. It was so great.
It is. Well, it's amazing when he gets fired up. I love it.
I have to say the commenters on the podcast for last week were less than kind. Let's put it that way.
Yeah,
so
you know,
thank you for putting
up great radio. But yeah, thank you.
You know what? I mean, there's a lot that we do really well here, and we do things. We hold ourselves to a very high standard for most of what we do in this job at Mobile Nations. Podcasting isn't really one of them, to be honest, and that's going to change in 2017. And well, we said that last year, but that's our commitment to you this year. We're going to podcast every week when we can. So, Subliminal, thank you for your question. Your comment, rather. We will stick to a schedule. We'll also stick to talking about Android, Google, and the entire technology ecosystem, starting this week with a phone that was launched only 3 days or so after CES ended, and that's the HTC U Ultra, and its slightly less interesting HTC U Play counterpart. So Andrew got to play with that, and unfortunately he can't be with us today, because I think he's still stuck in line at the Genius Bar at the Apple Store where he needs to repair his MacBook.
Wow.
But we'll try to step in for him here. What do you guys think? Jerry, is this phone interesting to you at all? Are you finding, you know, something to talk about with this all-glass design?
To me personally, no headphone jack. I'll never use it. But I kind of dig where they're going with the look. It's like a little bit of Pixel, which HTC built. You know, who knows who designed it? And then some of the shape from the A9 and the HTC 10. I like the way it looks. I know everybody else seems to hate it, but I do like the way it looks.
Yeah, that's like all glass design thing is really nice.
And then, the finish, it's kind of like that Galaxy S7 Blue, where it's a chameleon, and it just, depending on where you're at, the color changes. That's really neat.
Agreed. That's kind of like the Honor 8. Russell, any thoughts about like this overall move? I mean, you're not a big fan. Today in the Slack channel today, you kind of disparaged against these all glass phones. So this can't be very exciting to you unless you stick a case on it, which kind of defeats the purpose, right?
Yeah, I mean, they're pretty. You know, sitting at a distance, they're nice looking, and the photos that Andrew took were incredible, and he's describing to me, you know, all of the really neat things about the different colors that HTC chose, like the all black version. Really just sucks in light from everywhere. And the HTC logo is designed in such a way that really, like, depending on the angle you hold the phone, the logo is like not even there, which speaks to what Jerry was just saying. But yeah, it's all glass, and it's HTC's glass, you know, which it's a giant fingerprint magnet. It's a giant like micro abrasion magnet all around your phone. And, you know, I've been using this Pixel really only since October. And I'm looking at the like the back glass on my Pixel right now, and it's just destroyed. Like there's just scratches all over the place. You know, so I'm tired of Samsung doing it. I'm tired of HTC doing it. I hope that we can move on from this quickly, because they do look really pretty, but unfortunately they're only going to look really pretty for like 2 or 3 months. And that's even if you have a case on it.
Yeah. And it's really interesting looking at where this sits in the overall flagship ecosystem. I mean, it has a QHD display on the Ultra, to be specific. You know, it doesn't have that headphone jack, but other than that, it's very much a high-end Android phone for end of 2016, early 2017. It does have that weird dual display thing going on that debuted on the V10 and then was improved on the V20, but this is the first time HTC's doing it. And I wonder why. You know, it's not really something that I felt like other manufacturers should emulate. It's not like Android does a bad job with its regular notification shade. So, Jerry, what is it with manufacturers and this weird second display thing?
I don't know. I get the feeling that HTC just said, well, what can we do to make this phone worse? let's take the worst thing from LG's lineup and stick it on our new phone. Because it's, you know, there are some people who find it useful. I can't speak for everybody, but it's just no need to be there.
Right.
It's on at least on the V10, it put camera controls there. It doesn't even do that on the V20.
Right. It sounds, I mean, if looking at the screenshots and the photos that Andrew posted, you see things like notifications. You have access to quick toggles like your favorite contacts, your favorite apps, basically what you can already do on the V20. And judging by how I use it on the V20, and I wrote an article about this a few weeks ago saying, you know, it's very useful, but it's not something that I feel is essential to any phone today. I just don't think that HTC has, and it's not just HTC, but in particular, this company is desperate for a hit. They just don't have anything other than good hardware and decent software to really work with. You know, they cannot catch a break.
They make phones for Jerry, which don't sell in a world where Samsung exists. They make good, solid hardware, very slim software without a lot of gimmicks and pretty straightforward. And that's the kind of stuff I like, and I know some other people do, but most people want a little more.
So, Russell, let's talk a little about the way that they're selling this. So this is an online-only phone. It's, you know, it's got no support from any of the carriers in the U.S. It's going to be $749 from HTC.com. Why?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, we're going to be we find ourselves asking that question a lot about this phone, you know, because it's really expensive, which again, you know, HTC's design language has changed, which means the engineering has to be paid for, the materials are a little more expensive, and we see that with, you know, those are Samsung's excuses for, you know, the S7 and the S7 Edge, you know, when those phones were being released. And yeah, it's really hard to justify that here, you know, at least until we've seen a little more. And maybe there's something about it that really just, you know, kind of stands out and is exceptional in some way. But it's not obvious whatever that thing is right now.
And then there's the question of what, like, is there even a market for online for devices sold online only in the U.S. over $600? Because the Pixel, for, you know, all of our love for that phone, it's expensive. It's $650, and it's only sold through one carrier. But if it wasn't sold through any carriers, like say the Nexus 6P in the US, then would it even be a blip on the radar?
No, there was a post today. It's like 12.5% of Verizon's total activations in the fourth quarter were the Pixel. That tells you how important a carrier is in the States.
And that's a huge, that's also due to a huge marketing push from Google that went alongside things like the Google Home, which was also a much more accessible and more easily understood product. You know, people know the Echo, they understand it, and they recognize the Google brand. A product like the U Ultra from HTC is basically buried under all of under the weight of a brand that nobody really knows, nobody has any loyalty to, in the US at least, or nobody being very few people. And yet it's one of those intriguing products that I'm probably going to pick up and go, this thing's awesome. You know, this thing is a great example of a phone made by a manufacturer that's not directly from Google that I would use as my daily driver.
You know, on online sales, there's a market for online sales, but you mentioned that the price kind of shuffles the Ultra out, but then the expectations. OnePlus is fine with how many phones they can sell through just online marketing. OnePlus is that they can make money that way. HTC is an old style of business. They're too big. They can't make money from the number of phones that OnePlus would sell. And that's a problem.
Well, but I think we look at this entire arrangement, like from the announcement and, you know, just HTC's entire presentation here. This got released after the biggest trade show in the United States, like days after the biggest trade show in the United States, instead of, you know, putting it there where just hundreds of thousands of people could come and touch it themselves. You know, and instead HTC's, their entire presence at CES, was 100% VR and not even on the trade show floor. You know, they had a separate space, you know, that was just for, you know, their virtual reality experiences that they were doing, nothing to do with their phones at all. HTC did nothing, at CES. And then they turned around and did this. I think they know that this isn't something they're going to sell a lot of. I think they're doing this because, you know, it's a phone that has to sit in a slot and kind of exist while they figure out what happens next. You know, because their arrangement with Google is going to be a lot more successful, you know, at least over the next year or two. So they can kind of, you know, take a look at these other ideas like a second screen and like an all glass body and kind of see what sticks.
So, I mean, that brings us to the question of where it fits in HTC's product lineup. Right after this was announced, some rumors floated that this would replace the HTC One line, or at least, rather, not the One, but the successor to the HTC 10, which was, of course, based, you know, a successor to the One M9 and M8. And that was quickly, I think, debunked. We still don't know exactly what the phone will be called, nor when it will be released, and it doesn't make sense for it to be announced around MWC like previous HTC flagships. But there's no reason to think that HTC would eschew its smaller and equally, if not more so, powerful flagship for 2017. The question that remains, though, why launch this now, unless they had a reason or an obligation to do so for other markets? And my thinking is the Uplay comes into play, I guess, in some ways, because it's the same design, slightly less powerful, slightly smaller. But that phone, I think, has the potential to sell quite well in developing markets. You know, it's based on a MediaTek chip, fairly powerful, the Helio P10. It's got, you know, variables of between 3 and 4 gigs of RAM, up to 64 gigs of storage. It's got a decent camera, and it's running Nougat. So this phone could do quite well in markets that may not be able to support a $750 phone. What do you guys think of that?
No, I think that's exactly right. You know, we've seen a lot of attention recently paid to phones that are being released in India, especially, you know, phones that are, you know, being built exclusively for those markets. And I think that we're going to continue to see a big focus there.
Right. And Jerry, how much difference is there today between a MediaTek chip like the Helio P10 and say something like the Snapdragon 821, which is inside the U Ultra?
You know what? Pretty much it's support. If you buy an Android phone with a MediaTek chip, the first month you don't get a security update, worry, complain. They're notorious for, I don't want to say sloppy programming, but programming that gives vectors for attacks directly at the, you know, at the code that controls the kernel space. MediaTek is just horrible at that. Google does what they can to fix it. So the support is the bigger thing. Your Snapdragon, Qualcomm are jerks. They do things like purposefully not upgrade the capabilities of a chip that can support it without a problem, just to force manufacturers to buy the new version of the chip, which trickles down to us. We don't get updates on our Nexus 5. But they will support, you know, a Snapdragon for its entire life. And that's not just 2 years for a phone. They will support a Snapdragon chip probably for 5 or 6 years if it needs a critical bug fix or something. That to me is the biggest difference. The capabilities, a lot of people like the way Snapdragon does its core arrangements. MediaTek is more like Samsung. They will put more cores in a phone and, you know, not have two cores that really suck down the power. But in the long run, you're not going to see much of a difference.
So, you know, that brings up a good point. We're getting to this stage where Qualcomm sort of has the market cornered in the U.S., and so much so that they were even that the FTC filed a complaint against them this week for basically preventing Apple from dealing with any other baseband company until the iPhone 7, where they split the difference with Intel. But the argument was that Qualcomm forces companies to buy their patents or license their patents by giving them discounts on their they force companies to buy their chips by giving them discounts on the FRAND patents that they own. And the FRAND patents, I forget what the acronym stands for, but it's basically patents that should be freely made available to other companies in the name of sharing and improving the market. And this was something that Samsung was trying to use as justification when Apple sued them, conversely, about purportedly copying the design of their early Galaxy their iPhones with their early Galaxy phones. And these are the kinds of business practices that Qualcomm has been forced to pay up in places like China and South Korea. But on the other hand, the products themselves are kind of much better. I mean, there's no question, as a holistic provider of both systems on a chip and basebands and transceivers and everything else, there's no equal to Qualcomm in the mobile industry right now. Is that correct, Jerry?
I'll have to agree with you. FRAN stands for fair, reasonable, and non-discriminatory.
Thank you. I didn't have a Google search open at the moment. My brain was creating the acronym, so I was like, I'm just gonna roll with it.
I knew it was fair and reasonable. I had to look up the last part, so I looked it up for you real quick.
This is teamwork, folks.
That's right.
Real-time teamwork.
I know there is another company that was basically forced out of the phone market because they could not get... It would cost them way too much to use a Qualcomm modem because they wanted to use their own chip. That company no longer makes processors for smartphones. You know, I don't know all the business deals, but I do know that you can pretty much count on a Qualcomm chip having a better than average mobile radio.
Right. And what's interesting is, you know, today, every Android phone sold in North America basically does have a Qualcomm chip in it, except for Samsung. Samsung has the ability and has in the past sold phones with its own Exynos chip and modem. And now Huawei, with the Mate 9, has actually begun selling its Kirin 960 processor. And before it, with the Honor 8, it was the 950. And slowly but surely, there are competitors entering the market for, you know, to take on Qualcomm's dominance. So 2017 will be a very interesting year when it comes to diversification of not just the phones, but the components inside the phones, I think.
It's exciting.
And I want to talk a little bit about, you know, using that as a transition. I want to talk a little bit about the Huawei Mate 9. Alex Adobe, who lives in London, he got a chance to use the device kind of early on back in November. And I had a chance to play with it as well in New York. But there were hints, no promises, that it would come to the U.S. And then during CES, the company Huawei said that it would start selling the Mate 9 on Amazon and Newegg and a bunch of other online retailers. And Russell, the price was pretty astounding. It was $599 for a phone that is probably more powerful than anything else on the market today. Have you had a chance to use it? Or if not, what do you think about the phone?
I haven't had a chance to use it yet. And honestly, it's the more I hear about it, the more excited I get. And that's a first, you know, for this particular manufacturer. Because, you know, I really just feel like they warm up other ideas and stick them on top of products up until this point. But yeah, I mean, the little bit that I heard about during their presentation at CES, you know, the performance of the processor is something that I'm interested in seeing, especially when it comes to really kind of intense tasks. It was something that that Google spoke really highly about when talking about optimizing for Daydream, that they had a lot of success doing that, and you know, making that work was less of a challenge than they initially thought it was going to be. And so that excites me a lot for, you know, for what this could potentially be as a competitor to Qualcomm, and also making a legitimate claim for this brand in the US.
Yeah, Alex has been really excited about Huawei for a couple of years now, and I never really understood it because the software was always such a train wreck. And with the with EMUI 5 and Nougat, starting with the Mate 9, Huawei's really changed it around. I mean, EMUI 4.1 on the Honor 8 was my first time really delving into the company's software, and it's terrible. I mean, I feel bad for anybody who has to use it, but 5.0 is a lot better, and it's slowly trickling out to products like the Honor 8, the Nova series. So I like this phone. I've been using it as my daily driver. I'm doing a comparison between that and the V20. And I think they've done a great job. But Russell, I wanted to talk a little bit about Daydream, because you were in that keynote where and subsequent interview where Huawei and Google sort of explained why and how a device is certified for Daydream and why the regular Mate 9 wasn't certifiable, whereas the higher resolution Mate 9 Pro and Porsche design Mate 9 were. Can you talk a little bit about that?
I can, and I'm going to tangent a little bit while I do this, because we're going to get comments here and then probably notes in our forums about how it's actually super easy to sideload Daydream onto the normal Mate 9 and then just use Daydream. So, you know, Google could have just done it and it would have been fine. Google has a set of specifications, you know, for performance. A phone has to perform at a certain level for motion tracking and for response time and things like that in order to be Daydream certified, so that you have kind of a minimum set of expectations for, you know, really primarily motion tracking. You know, motion blur in VR, especially if you're moving your head around really quickly, can very easily cause nausea and a lot of problems, even in people who are very used to using virtual reality headsets. And so that set of specifications that they have for Daydream is very specific for that performance level. And when, you know, as it was explained, LCD screens that we use today just aren't capable of matching that refresh rate, you know, the what they call photon to motion free range, you know, where it has to be within, I think it's 0.2 milliseconds or something like that, where, you know, there's just that response time between when you move your head and when the image changes on the display. And that's why all of the phones that run Daydream right now are AMOLED. None of them are LCD, and there's a hope that in the future, you know, there will be some partnerships with LCD technology manufacturers to you know, find a way to fix that so that there can be future LCD displays that handle this and can be used in Daydream. But currently, you know, AMOLED is where it's at for this kind of technology. So it really, any LCD phone, you know, doesn't meet Google standards right now, is what it really comes down to.
Right. And I don't see how they can fix it, because AMOLED has one thing going for it: individual pixels. You can control them however you want instantly. You can't do that on an LCD.
Yep. And that's so interesting. It never, until you wrote that article, it never occurred to me that every phone up till now was certified for Daydream used an AMOLED display. It was the Pixel and Pixel XL, then it was the Moto Z and Moto Z Force, and then it was the Mate 9 Pro and Porsche design, and then it was the Axon 7. And even though we heard way, way back that the Axon 7 would be certified, it still hasn't been, because Nougat hasn't rolled out yet.
Right.
But all five or six of those phones have AMOLED displays, and it makes so much sense now that you think about it. But yeah, I mean, I don't know. I used Daydream with the regular Pixel, which has a 1080p AMOLED display, and it's not great, you know. So I think that even then, you want a higher resolution display, and pixel density still matters.
Oh, so, yeah. Pixel density is incredibly important for the what they call the screen door effect, where you can kind of see the lines in between the pixels, and it forms this grid that you can see through the through the lenses that are being used. I wish that Google didn't approve any 1080p screens to be used in Daydream, because none of them are good. And, you know, the what we have right now is the same, you know, resolution and roughly the same pixel density as what we have on Samsung phones. And that's really kind of like the base level for what you can use for extended periods of time and be comfortable. So people often come to me with like the Pixel or more recently the Axon 7 and say, is it worth, you know, going and getting Daydream so that it's ready? And I'm often not a fan. You know, if you have a 1080p screen, you know, it's not really worth the $80 to you, because it's not going to be comfortable for a long time.
So what about devices like the Galaxy S7 and S7 Edge? You know, those have AMOLED displays, and they have QHD resolution screens. But of course, Samsung wants to push their proprietary Gear VR ecosystem. Is there a chance that even with a bit of hacking, the Galaxy S7s could be compatible with Daydream?
Sure. I mean, Google's not going to force it on anyone, but we've seen the Daydream framework loaded on several Nougat phones that Google has not certified, and I wish that these people would stop it, because they're going to make themselves sick. But yeah, it happens all the time right now, where a phone doesn't have Daydream support and Daydream support gets sideloaded. It's not a complicated thing once Nougat is running on the phone.
Yeah. And if you haven't tried Daydream yet, it's really good. It's something else. I if you haven't gone to VR Heads, read all of Russell's guides. That's where they live. And they're awesome. And they explain why you want to try Daydream.
And then go down to the Verizon store. They'll let you try it.
Yeah, you can try them at Verizon stores. They're not doing the demonstrations yet, but they're setting them up so that a lot of Best Buy locations will do them as well. Where you'll be able to just walk in and try them out.
Interesting. Okay, speaking of demonstrations, again, another really good segue here. There's a demonstration of the Nintendo Switch down the street in a couple of days in my hometown of Toronto. That was announced way back last year, but Russell, you've been covering this for iMore, our increasingly less Apple-centric sister site, and you'll hear a lot more about that in the weeks and months to come. I'm obsessed with this thing. I love how it looks. I love what it could do. I'm not so impressed with the launch titles, but why don't you tell us a little bit about the Switch and why it's so cool?
Yeah, so it's funny. Since it came out, I've talked to a couple, or since it was, revealed a couple months ago, I've talked to, a couple of people that I know from NVIDIA and a couple of people at other, game manufacturers and people who are, tablet people. And I've been the one Nintendo nerd for a while. Like I'm one of the few people I know that own a Wii U and actually use it on a regular basis still. So I've been excited about this. Nintendo had my money a while ago, regardless. But kind of the unifying thing here is that this is for a lot of people the direction that a lot of people were hoping tablets were going to go. Over the last couple of years, and it never really happened. You'd talk to people at NVIDIA when the original Shield tablet came out, and there were accessory pin sets where accessories like docks and controllers and things could have been made for the Shield, but it was either never popular enough to bother, or NVIDIA just didn't have what it took to get them mass produced in time. So they never really existed, and that's what we're seeing here. NVIDIA made the physical hardware for the Nintendo Switch, and it's a tablet that isn't all that different from the NVIDIA Shield tablet that can dock into a special container that connects to a television so that you can play as though you were playing on a normal game console. And then when you want it to be portable, you remove the tablet from the dock without having to do anything, no like settings or anything. You could be in the middle of a game. I actually watched this happen and was amazed. Could be in the middle of a game and pull the tablet out without pressing pause or anything, and the gameplay just immediately transfers to the other screen and doesn't skip a beat. And the controller splits in half and will actually connect to either side of the tablet so that you can then go around and play not just, the campaign of a game that you were playing by yourself, but also multiplayer with other Switch owners through, I think it's up to 8 people through a local mesh network that the tablets can create. So you have all of the benefits of a game console in the portable form factor that we've had in tablets for years. And I love it. I'm a huge fan of the idea.
Okay, so my first question is, what are the compromises? When you think of a game console, and you look at something really powerful, or I guess relatively powerful, like the Xbox One S or the PlayStation 4 Pro, and then you compare it to something running ARM-based hardware that's the SoC of which was launched at CES 2016, so a year ago, and something that's optimized for both using on the go and on a television at 1080p, what do you think are the inherent risks here for Nintendo? I mean, are they losing anything by not competing on a hardware specs level with Microsoft and Sony?
Not really. I mean, Nintendo has never competed on a hardware specs level with Sony or Microsoft. It's just they've always been considered basically one generation behind as far as performance goes, because their titles are generally speaking more animated and less focused on the kind of gaming that you get from those other experiences. But really the only hurdle is trying to fit this into the box that you would fit the Wii U or even like the previous Nintendo game consoles into, in that this is basically a portable NVIDIA Shield TV. It does all the same stuff.
Minus one thing. I have a Shield tablet, and really the only thing I do with it is connect it to my computer at home, and I can play the same character when I'm playing Splinter Cell or Fallout 3 that I have on my PC. Because it's actually playing on my PC and it's displayed on the tablet in front of me. If they would have connected this with the Wii U so you could slide a game into the Wii U and play it on your handheld, that would have just put it over the top. And to me, that's they're lacking there. That not including that, I think, is a mistake.
Yeah, I mean, that is a big challenge here, is that this is another Nintendo product that doesn't have backwards compatibility. And because it's not, because it's in this weird in-between world with the 3DS and with the Wii U, it's not backwards compatible with either of the, you know, the existing platforms that Nintendo has. So, you know, unless Nintendo flips over and says, hey, we're doing, you know, digital download support for everything that you purchased on the Wii U so that you can play it on the Switch, you're stuck with basically two consoles if you're still playing things on the Wii U. And that is a genuine problem.
How likely is that, though, for them to incorporate digital versions of older generation games? I mean, we have them on the Wii U to some extent, but they're not. I mean, you're looking at like GameCube games and Wii games, but is it likely that we'll be able to get the same performance out of maybe an emulated Wii U game on the Switch?
Well, the problem there isn't that the hardware isn't capable, because it's, you know, similar enough that you know, it could be converted to do that. Every single Wii U game was designed for a two-screen approach, where you have the display, you know, in your hand was doing something, and the display on the television was doing something, and you work together in order to play the game that you were playing. It was mandatory for a while that every single Wii U game behaved that way. And, you know, so it's possible to do that and have that work on the Switch. But the compromise that you run into there is that you don't have a second screen anymore. So the game would have to be, you know, limited in some ways. And in that case, you probably can't be portable and play those games.
Right.
Even if Nintendo says, yeah, we're going to support this, I would suspect that it's something that they would add later, because their focus right now is, you know, making sure that everyone knows that every single thing you do on this, you know, tablet, you can also do on the television, you can also do with friends. You know, it's this unified experience wherever you are.
And that one, the thing that Nintendo is better at than anybody else is games that are fun. Mario Party. Russell, they need to make a Mario Party for that thing. Plug it into the TV and you and three friends and a bunch of beer just can have a blast.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, that they do that better than anybody else, and that's something
actually
that you don't
a
get.
A big part of what they did with these controllers, because we haven't actually talked about these controllers yet. These controllers are weird, crazy magic science. Like,
okay, tell people what they're called first.
So they're called Joy-Con. The Joy-Con controllers, and it's a pair of controllers that in most situations is a single controller. Like there's a dock, and you hold it like you would an Xbox controller. But then when you separate the two controllers from themselves, you have two options. You can either connect it to either side of this tablet and have a single cohesive portable unit, or you can actually prop up the tablet with the kickstand that's baked in, and each one of these halves becomes their own separate controller, so that you can hand half to someone else and then go and play games. But that they extended that with a vibration system that is very similar to Apple's Taptic Engine. So that a lot of the games that you end up playing are, very motion focused when you're playing with friends. There's one where, you know, you're like rolling a ball, and you can actually feel in your hand the way that the motion of the ball is moving in your hand as you move it. And then they take the top of the controller has the same kind of sensory system, or a similar sensory system to the original Wii controllers. Adding motion sensing to them as well, and distance sensing. So you can actually tell when you are a certain distance from something, and can use that in a bunch of the games that they end up playing. So like the controllers themselves are like their own separate thing to be excited about.
So what is that? How does that separate the Switch from Nintendo's always been, I think, as much as they've been behind in specs, they've always been ahead in input. They've really tried to move the typical way that we play games beyond just the two-handed controller. And they've done a great job with that, with the going all the way back to the Wii. And I'm excited about this because it allows you to do so many cool new things. But I also worry that there aren't going to be enough great games taking advantage of them, and that they may just default to what we know as, you know, a typical game controller input. Have you seen anything that's excited you really about these new input potentials?
Yeah, so you know they're starting off with a couple of mini games basically, and they did the same thing with the Wii and the Wii U, where it's kind of like teaching you how to use each one of these games. And the first thing that popped up that really excited me is this fighting game, where you're actually holding the controllers in your hand and you're throwing physical punches, and it was very reminiscent of how you would play on the Wii, but entirely portable. You know, no wires anywhere, no nunchuck controller or anything. It's entirely separate, and they've actually built this up so that it's going to be its own separate game that you'll be able to play online with friends and you know, against the computer that's going. And there's a couple of games that are built like that, that are, you know, very, you know, in Nintendo's playbook, you know, where they kind of set this up. But the thing that will excite me isn't so much the launch title light up as Nintendo's ability to share this with the game development community and have them turn this, you know, into more. Because more than anything over the last year, what we've seen is small development teams, especially in virtual reality, as a platform, be able to take, you know, weird design concepts and weird motion concepts and turn them into really fun games. And to give that group, which has, you know, grown so much over the last year, access to these controllers on the Switch, I think is going to create a ton of amazing new stuff.
Wafus everywhere.
Yeah, and also that
Joy-Con wafus.
Yeah,
that vibrate.
Well, I mean, they have to have a conference called the Joy-Con where that's people just have like Switches everywhere and just play mesh multiplayer games all the time. I mean, that's a given.
That has to happen.
Yeah. And you will attend that and write.
I will.
It.
Yep.
So, I mean, another thing that Nintendo is doing, and I think doing an interesting if not good job at, is releasing mobile games for Android and iOS. And we know about Super Mario Run. It was released for iOS last year, and it was an exclusive for a while. We now know that it'll be coming to Android in March, not on any particular day in March, but you may know by the time you listen to this. But we know of another game that will be a launch on Android on the same day as it will be on iOS, and that's Fire Emblems. And I know nothing about this game, Russell. I've heard about it. I know it's an RPG. That's where my experience with it ends. So why don't you tell everybody why people should get excited about this?
Wafus. Yeah, so the Fire Emblem... Or go ahead, Jerry.
I just said wafus. That's why people get excited over it.
The Fire Emblem series is... it goes back really far into Nintendo's heritage as you know, an RPG series that has just extended for a really long time. And this one is being called Fire Emblem Heroes. And instead of being kind of the straightforward, you know, turn-by-turn role-play game, like almost Final Fantasy style, what we're seeing is a top-down strategy game, you know, the tactics games, you know, where you have kind of a grid map and you, you know, arrange your characters to go forth and use their skills to do things. And so the battle system is going to be built loosely around that. And the thing that is going to be exciting about this is Nintendo seems to fully get the way that mobile gaming needs to work in a way that weirdly Square Enix hasn't, after releasing so many of their Final Fantasy games as ports to Android and iOS. They still haven't figured this out. Is, you know, a complete mobile redesign or a complete mobile envisioning of this game includes a massive online component where you're able to build your squad and you know, take them through the story, but then also go and take that team and put it against all of your friends, you know, total online multiplayer, you know, tactics combat. And the setup they have for it looks really elegant.
So, I mean, that's something that so many other free-to-play games have found success with. Game of War, Clash of Clans, you know, pig of horse, whatever of game you want.
All of the games where the icon is some dude with his mouth open.
Yes, it's a little
shouting
bit tired.
At you. Yeah.
And if you open the Play Store, there's a new, I guess, welcome screen, if you want to call it that, that Google rolled out a few weeks ago. And those games, those free-to-play games, are more prominent than ever. And it's really hard to distinguish between the good from the bad. You know, our own Mark Legace, who's our games editor at AC, he loved Clash Royale. He thought it was the perfect blend of kind of free-to-play card and in-app purchase. You know, you don't have to grind to actually have fun, but you can spend a little bit of money, but you're not spending money to win. You're spending money to actually improve your experience. And I think companies like Supercell have struck a good balance. There were a lot of people who were very upset with Nintendo for the way that they rolled out Super Mario Run. You know, they charge $9.99 for the rest of the game after you get to play the first of six worlds.
Three. You get to play the first three worlds.
You're right. Wait, the first three worlds or levels?
The first three level, the first three levels of the first world.
Yes, right. Okay, so there are six worlds altogether, and you basically have to spend $10 to unlock the rest. Jerry, is that a business model that you think is the right move for Nintendo, or is that going to undermine its success in mobile gaming going forward?
Man, that's tough, because the opposite was, what was the last one that came out, Russell? Final Fantasy V?
Yeah.
I think. And it was $17, and it was just everything, but it was $17, and nobody tried it. Nobody wanted to spend $17 to see if it was any good. Whereas with Mario Run, you get to at least see if it's good before you spend your $20. I don't know which one is better. Maybe I'm odd if I want to play Mario Run, I just $20, I'll buy Mario Run. You know, hopefully I'll get $20 worth of enjoyment out of it. But a lot of people aren't that way. They're a little bit more frugal when it comes to spending money on apps. So I don't know. I guess the answer is still the Clash of Clans model. I mean,
well,
that's it.
I think Mario, Nintendo's tactic here, I don't necessarily disagree with it. I personally am like Jerry, where, you know, I'll just pay the $20 and play the game. But the teaser thing that happened here, what aggravated me as I went to play it wasn't that it said, okay, you've played this far, you need to give us $9 now. It was when it happened. You know, I feel like if I had gotten to play through the entire first world, which for people who don't know was just one more level, because there's three levels and then the castle. So if I'd gotten to play through the castle and gotten that whole first world experience, then, you know, I would have been able to look at that and say, okay, yeah, sure, this is totally worth $10 and been fine. Because you can play through those as many times as you want, and there's a value in doing so, because there's different, you know, hidden coins that you can find through as you go and play it. And as you beat them, you gain tickets that you can spend to race your character's time trial against other online characters. And that's, you can play at any time. You don't have to spend $10 to play that part of the game, which I think was also a good idea. I feel like Nintendo just needed to move the needle just a little bit, and I would have been perfectly okay with it.
Yeah, I mean, I love the idea of normalizing the mobile gaming market around trial experiences. So instead of grinding and having to purchase gems and eventually spending your entire savings on this in-game currency that you'll never get back, the idea of trying a game and having some fun and getting a decent amount of free content from it, and then spending money once, or, you know, it doesn't preclude additional in-app purchases, right? I want the full game for a single amount of money, and then by all means, ask me to pay for more things if I want to. For, you know, if I have a customizable character, I wouldn't mind spending a bit more money on a new sash or something really great, or even to unlock additional levels. But there is something to be said for Nintendo's straightforward approach to Super Mario Run. You spend once and you get the whole game. I agree with you, Russell. I just don't think the implementation was particularly friendly or nuanced. It was just very cut and dry. Your experience is over. Give us $10 or you can't have any fun ever again.
Well, you know, my biggest problem is I have an iPhone. Don't shoot me, but it's a 5S. I like the 5S. It's little. I like that phone. And you could download Super Mario Run on the 5S. My wife has a 5C. It wouldn't download it. The 5S should not have been able to download that game because I didn't even make it to the point where it asked me to buy it because it ran like crap. That should have been caught, you know, Nintendo or Apple, because if it gave me a bad experience and I no longer had any interest, it had to give others the same. So I don't know what you guys are talking about. I didn't make it that far.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, it also comes down to the fact that, like, Super Mario Run just isn't that great a game. It's fun, it's good, but I wasn't chomping at the bit to unlock the rest of the game. And in Canada, it's $14 because of our exchange rate. So maybe that was a bit more of a roadblock for me, just seeing that number, knowing that, okay, I'm going to have to spend $14 on a game that I may not love the crap out of the way that I'm happy to unlock many other games. So I don't know. I mean, I don't think there's one right or wrong answer here. I like the fact that Nintendo is finally taking mobile gaming seriously. I'm very excited about the Switch. I think there's something to be said for innovation in gaming input over just focusing on specs. And Nintendo's shown it with many, many generations. And just judging by the success of the Nintendo Classic, they are capitalizing on that nostalgia once again. That they're not out of the game, so to speak. I'm a terrible dad joke teller.
I hope we see a future title. You know, Fire Heroes would have been great, that you can play online with the Switch or an Android tablet or an iPad and have the same characters and play against each other. Nintendo, if you can do that, you win. Period.
Yeah, I mean, that's true. And honestly, if more than anything, I think Nintendo is learning really quickly with the software that they're working on. You know, we're not seeing the same, you know, obvious pitfalls with what we've seen so far with Fire Emblem Heroes and the stuff that we're seeing with the Switch. A big part of it is parental controls that are entirely managed in real time from an app that you will be able to use on your phone. So if you'll get notifications if your kid has been, you know, using the Switch for, you know, 2 hours in a single day, if you tell it to do so, and you can just remotely turn it off if you decide that's been happening. So, I think that Nintendo got mocked a lot for not really getting online gameplay and not really getting, you know, in the previous generation, you know, how that was working. If that's true, if they genuinely didn't get it, they're learning really quickly, you know, both in their apps for mobile devices and their apps that you use with mobile devices.
I just know there's going to be a phone in Russell's house that constantly is saying Russell's playing on the Switch.
Oh, yeah, yeah. That thing's never, like, I may actually have to get a second one because the chances of me sharing mine is really unlikely. They're launching the game with a Zelda title. I mean, like, they already had my money.
And that's smart. That's they had me looking twice because I like Zelda, too.
And then there's Splatoon 2 coming in the summer, is going to be so fun. Great for kids, too.
I will never forget when I streamed Splatoon 2 and Phil sat and watched for a half an hour and could not figure out what I was doing.
Awesome.
And he was just talking. He was just like, I don't know what this game is, but it's really entertaining to watch. Like,
and that's what they do best. I think a lot of people dismiss the idea of shooting with paint when the first Splatoon came out, and then it became this huge thing. And
yeah, just silly
kids,
stuff.
Parents, everyone loves it.
Yeah.
So I kind of want to transition there. You know, we're talking about the NVIDIA-built Nintendo Switch. And we have another NVIDIA product that was announced at CES. Andrew took a look at that as well. It's the NVIDIA Shield Android TV, second generation. And Jerry, this is the same hardware, more or less, as the first inside, but there's some subtle tweaks. There's some changes to the exterior. It's half the size. There's a improved remote. There's a new there's a much improved controller. And the NVIDIA finally did what it could to round out the software experience, adding 4K HDR support for Netflix and Amazon Video, and improvements to GeForce Now and GameStream. So is this the box that everybody should be buying right now?
Yes.
Okay, done. Okay, thanks, yes. Guys. See you later.
Yeah, we're done. Yep.
It's
what other options are there right now? Well, I mean, seriously.
Yeah, what other good options?
That Mi Box
Xiaomi
thing?
Makes, yeah.
Was this, a lump of plastic that, you know, didn't do anything.
Well, even worse, it did things half-ass, and that's just bad all around. It just don't do it. Well, like my 5S with Mario Run, you're better off not to do it than to do it poorly. And the Shield TV is, I mean, there was no need for new hardware. Once NVIDIA figured out how to, you know, stream 4K HDR with the processor that's in it now, that was the only thing it couldn't do, and they shoehorned it in there. Nobody makes anything any better for streaming video or playing games, which is, you know, basically what a TV box does. You watch videos or you play games. And then because the hardware didn't change, the core hardware components, all the old Shield TV customers get all this new stuff in an update. That's... If I was wearing a hat, I'd have to tip it to NVIDIA, because that's, in the Android world, that's unheard of. iPhone users know what that feels like, to get everything that your phone can do that from the new stuff, you get it when you update. That doesn't happen in Android. You know, the Note 5 isn't getting the fancy UI from the Note 7. You have to do it yourself. But NVIDIA just said, here you go.
And to be clear, the biggest physical hardware change was the controller. Because, I mean, the Shield TV itself shrunk a little bit, but really that was just removing the hard drive bay.
Yeah, and they did a little bit better with heat management. They could afford to go a little smaller. Smaller is better behind your TV.
And but that they controller did... is a huge difference.
Yeah, I can't say I hated the old controller. I don't know exactly what it needed updated, you know, to work with an assistant that's going to come, you know, with the microphone and always listening. I assume there was some pretty major design changes inside the thing. And it comes with an exterior that Andrew says it's better to hold, and another person I know that has it says it just feels better. So good all around. This is worth $300. If you want, you know, this to connect to your TV in your living room, this is the one to buy.
But here's the thing, and here's where my skepticism comes in. Google has all but abandoned Android TV from a hardware perspective through basically discontinuing its Nexus player. Nobody else except Xiaomi is making Android TV hardware, and the Xiaomi Mi Box is a piece of crap. So why is nobody else taking advantage of this hugely lucrative, potentially lucrative market to take on, you know, the big names like Apple and Microsoft and Sony? Like, this is competing with the Apple TV on one hand and with the Xbox and PlayStation on the other, and it's not doing a bad job. So where is everybody else in this category?
There are no other manufacturers that are Android manufacturers that could release something that would compete with what NVIDIA has done.
Unless they used NVIDIA parts inside it.
Right, unless they used NVIDIA parts and then licensed NVIDIA's software, you know, their Shadow Play stuff and all of that. None of those features can be done by another manufacturer that isn't NVIDIA right now unless they license the stuff. But really, you know, the step back, none of these smart TV things are exactly, like, exploding. And that includes Apple's TV
except
system.
Except the Samsung one, but that one's... you know, nobody's talking about that one.
That was a good one. I left the door open for that one. I mean, it's comparatively nobody buys these things. You know, the Apple TV is not popular.
It's not dead.
It's not. No, I don't think it
because
is.
Because if you go buy a smart TV in 2017, chances are it's going to run Android TV. It's not going to be great to play games or anything, but that's how you connect to YouTube and Netflix. Before it was some Java Brew nonsense or Roku software. Now, most of the time, it's going to be Android TV. So it's alive and well on that front. But the set-top
boxes, you can't forget
that
Android TV is being bundled with every Bravia set from Sony.
Yeah.
So that's a fair chunk of TVs that are just, you know, getting purchased every day at Best Buy, and people may not even know that it's running Android TV. They're just like, oh, it's pretty. It's Sony.
There are apps.
And, you know, that's not a bad thing. But we saw LG double down on webOS at CES. We have Samsung with its own Tizen, whatever the hell it's doing with Tizen on the television. So, you know, everybody can access Netflix, but there are so many distinct advantages to Android TV just by running Android and allowing developers to essentially repurpose an APK and call it a TV app, right? I'd love to see companies take it more seriously.
I think here's the thing, and I think this speaks also to what you were saying about Google, you know, not releasing a new Nexus player. I think Google did the Nexus player because they got a whole lot of feedback from Chromecast people saying, you know, what this thing really needs is a controller. I need a remote. You know, the old people saying I need a remote to do stuff. It's not always convenient to have my phone in my hand. And then they've released the Android TV and NVIDIA released the Shield TV, and it turned out that nobody actually cared about the remote. That, you know, when you end up having to spend more for it, and so, you know, NVIDIA, they opened up the door in a way that is unique, you know, with the mm-hmm. gamepad support on top of all this other stuff. And even with the Sony Bravia TVs, you get the Android TV stuff and you get a remote that'll access it and do stuff, but it's still not really what I would call a gaming platform compared to what NVIDIA has done with the Shield.
Right.
Well, and they took the Android games that can be put in Google Play, and that, you know, all those are included, but then they went further with, like you mentioned, GameStream and GeForce Now. And GameStream works awesome. GeForce Now kind of depends on your internet and where you live. But that's impressive, too. It actually works as described, and that sometimes doesn't happen.
Yeah, I think that's a feature that few people quite understand just what goes into.
Yeah.
This idea that the game itself is being hosted somewhere else in the world, and you're just playing it over a very fast internet connection in real time.
Right. It's one of those, I mean, it works for me. Apparently there's a data center close. I live in the mountains. Mountains are great places for data centers because the weather's cool. And I don't have a lot of people where I live, so our internet isn't congested. I, you know, GeForce Now is great for Jerry. It's horrible for Andrew in downtown Seattle. So it's hit or miss, but if you have a Shield TV or if you buy one, it's something that you ought to try. I'm sure you get a free trial. You know, give it a try. And if you have the PC hardware, you know, make sure you try GameStream. And that's what holds it back. You've got $300 worth of video card required on your PC before you can use it, which not everybody has.
Right. I mean, that is obviously something to contend with, this need for a 50 megabit connection. But I think in a couple of years, or maybe 5 years, when that's a lot less, or a lot more common in most parts of the U.S. I mean, I'm not saying most people will have it, but it'll be accessible. Fios is rolling out, and AT&T is doing a pretty good job getting gigabit out there. If that does reach a point where the average consumer can afford a 100, 200, 500 megabit connection, these kinds of systems will be a lot more compelling because we'll be able to access them on a $50 box with a pretty good but not great controller. And they'll be PC quality graphics and games essentially running on a system that has Android as a, you know, as a backdrop. I don't know. I mean, I think it's cool.
I mean, maybe even a system that's not Android. It's just a $50 box like the Gamefly thing tried to be.
Wasn't that Android? Everything's Android.
Well, even if I mean, it's not but Android, it's Android. Not, it's
my
not
toaster.
It's not Google Play, Android, install Clash of Clans. You know, it's, heck, the Switch has some Android DNA in there. You're right. Everything runs it because it's free, but it's not the Android you would think that you had on your phone or your tablet or something.
Right.
But, well, I agree with you that streaming is the future for everything. The skeptics were around when we all said streaming was the future for video, and they said, no, it's not. They were wrong, and the people that are skeptical now about streaming being the future for gaming are going to be proven wrong because it's cheap.
Well, it's based on, you know, if you have an unlimited bandwidth plan for your through your ISP, yeah, it's cheap. It's you know, it's free essentially. You don't pay any more than what you pay per month.
Right, and I forget what NVIDIA charges because I don't even pay attention. I just pay it.
And then someday we'll get game streaming on mobile devices. That'll happen on your cellular connection, and the T-Mobile version will be free, but only if you use the 10 pixels in the top left corner of your screen to play the game.
Well, or they'll let you use the whole screen at, you know, with 10 pixels by 10 pixels, and
that's
then
right.
You'll just have to approximate what you're doing.
Everything will be Rock'em Sock'em Robots.
Play the new Elder Scrolls 6 in 2019 at 10 frames per second.
Yeah.
Well, I don't think we have to worry about the FCC getting in T-Mobile's way from a regulatory perspective anytime soon, at least not for the next 4 years. So they'll continue doing what they're doing, for better or for worse.
No, for worse. Let's not even put better in the picture. For worse.
You know, I'd love to have a full podcast dedicated to zero rating and the FCC and the regulatory environment in the U.S. because I think that there's something... I don't think there's anything inherently bad with zero rating. I don't think T-Mobile is going out of its way to undermine the free and open internet. I do think that the way that they're going about it is a bit underhanded by essentially lying to customers. But the technology itself, which is the thing that the FCC should be regulating, I don't think that is inherently dangerous. Once you get into sort of the sponsored traffic side of things, that's where things get a little bit murky, right? So if T-Mobile is taking money from a Netflix or a Google Play or DirecTV or whatever to give that traffic for free, but is not allowing the smaller streaming companies to do the same thing because they don't have the pocketbooks as deep, that's where things get bad.
Well,
right?
That's what we need to do. We totally need to have like that separate standalone conversation. And honestly, John Ledger or Leger, I always mess his name up, and now I feel like a dick for what I'm about to say. You are invited to this podcast for that conversation. And you can also bring with you the guy that actually answers all of the questions for you. Mike Sievert is his name. So you can both come on and participate in this talk. I think it would be a really good one.
I would love to have it. I think it would be a very compelling hour or
mature two. Audience MA-17 rated podcast.
Let's table that for another day, but I think we'll end there because that's been an hour on its own of pretty compelling podcasting, if I do say so myself. Thank you
and
so much for joining us.
Say so himself.
I do. I will, and I have. Once again, Jerry Hildenbrand, if people want to find you somewhere on the vast, if they're not going to stalk you to your mountain lair or range or wherever the heck you live, where can they find you on the internet?
Well, first I want to say I screwed up. The Shield TV is $200.
I said
$300.
It's 300 Canadian. I know you get that confused.
Well, it was a mistake because I don't pay half attention to the stuff that comes out of my mouth. But it's $200, so if you're listening, the people I know from NVIDIA, don't shoot me. It was a mistake. $200, everybody, not three. But you can find me on Twitter, and that's pretty much the only place you're going to be able to find me social, and I'm hiding. I'm hiding for the foreseeable future, but I still peek, and it's at GBHIL. That's my first name, last name, middle name. Acronym, like some sort of government agency thing.
All right. Well, thank you, Mr. CIA.
Yeah.
And Russell Hawley, where can people find you?
I am at Russell Hawley on just about everything. Pretty easy to track down. I do not have a mountain lair.
Two L's. Russell Hawley. Good stuff. And my name is Daniel Bader. You can find me on Twitter at JourneyDan. You can find us all at androidcentral.com. Thank you so much for tuning in. As I said at the beginning of the show, we promise to be a bit more consistent in the next few weeks. I know we had a few weeks of inconsistent releases, so thank you for sticking around, and we really appreciate it.
And no one's eating Skittles.
What's that?
No one's eating Skittles.
Nobody. Oh, is that what it was? Okay, nobody's eating Skittles.
No bags of Skittles were opened or consumed during this podcast or the next podcast.
Yes, please forgive Phil and go visit him at Modern Dad. He really, really, really wants to see you. That's it for the show. Thanks again, and we will see you next week.
Goodbye.
Bye.
Adios.